Hello, and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking with my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, I'm speaking with editor Andy Jurgensen, editor of Paul Thomas Anderson's Licorice Pizza. Andy's work on the film has garnered him a BAFTA and an Ace Eddie nomination for Best Editing. Andy has been part of Anderson's post team on Inherent Vice, on which he served as assistant editor, and on Phantom Thread, on which he worked as associate editor. If you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, and even images of Andy's bins that he talks about in the podcast, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Thank you for joining me. You have had a long relationship with Paul. I interviewed Dylan Titchener for Phantom Thread. Tell me about you moving your way into the inner circle and up the ladder in the group.
Well, I started working with Paul on Inherent Vice. So that was 2014, and you know, I started out as an assistant editor, and great experience with Leslie. I'd worked with Leslie before. And we kind of does these sort of side projects from time to time, music videos or little things for Johnny or whatever. So he just started calling me to help him out. And so that started our relationship. But then Phantom Thread was just a different animal because we went to London for that movie. Because we do everything on film and we do these film dailies, it's hard to do this kind of thing in another country. In LA, we have the bubble of being close to Photochem and just having everything here. You can just send a PA to do something. Being in London, being so far away, and we did have a lab in London, but it just was such a different animal being somewhere like that. Basically, I think he's just slowly welcomed me into the circle. He trusts me now. I mean, a lot of the people that work with him have worked with him for a long time, and we know his sensibilities. The way he makes movies is so unique. So I think that's part of it. I had worked on this 15-minute sort of music video thing with Netflix for Thom Yorke called Anima. And so that was the biggest thing that I had ever done with him as a sole editor. And Dylan was on Eternals, so that was maybe part of it. But Paul just asked me to do the movie, and I was thrilled, obviously.
I'm sure it's wonderful to be trusted, and I'm sure it's a big thing, is just trust, that you want to know that you trust the editor, that the editor's got your back. I also noticed that one of your other last videos that's in IMDb is the Haim Valentine video.
Yeah, we've done a bunch of Haim videos. That's how we got to know that family, is through doing music videos. And I've cut pretty much all of those videos. So maybe that was part of it too. I've been part of the Haim process and then now onto this movie. Maybe he wanted to just continue on with that.
And you also mentioned, of course, the 35mm film aspect. You're a relatively young guy. Like, I mean, I didn't even work on film myself, and I'm in my late 50s. Where do you even find an assistant? You probably originally when you started working there, but now you have to find an assistant that is capable of working in 35mm film and all of what that entails.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're still obviously cutting digitally, but during the shoot, we're watching film dailies. So we do sort of have to prep that. And then once we get to a point, we do conform work print. So we have two assistants. Jay Troutman was our first assistant, who was great. And I had to find someone that was really on it and teach him everything that I had learned on the past two movies, all these little things. And even just from Inherent Vice to now, so many things have gone away as far as equipment that we used to be able to use that just is obsolete, or they don't make it anymore, or it's broken. Various things, the negative cutter. And then our film assistant is Bill Fletcher, who's actually done a lot. He's worked on Tarantino's movies and Chris Nolan. So he kind of rotates around.
Rotates around the three directors that cut on film.
He does. I mean, honestly, yeah. So he's amazing. So that was our team, basically. And we pulled it off this time.
Wow. What a different way to work with the 35mm film dailies, and fascinating to hear about.
Yeah. No, I mean, I feel pretty lucky to be straddling these two ways of filmmaking. It's so fun. Yes, it can be annoying at times because there's all these extra elements that we have to make, but it's so special being in this old style of filmmaking. And then, you know, obviously I do other movies too. So it's fun bringing both sides of it. They influence each other. So it's a unique experience.
Love it. Talk to me about the difference between cutting a film that is entirely digital, or at least edited entirely digital, and then how screening dailies as a group or screening dailies on film changes the way you watch dailies?
I mean, it's invaluable. It's one of the best things that Paul does. That's one thing that he keeps alive from the old days. And he's been doing it from the beginning. Phantom Thread, again, because we had this issue with being in London and we couldn't watch film every single day. So we would get selects every week. But still, he would watch the dailies with the dailies colorist to go over to Technicolor and watch it digitally. But this is the perfect scenario because we have a place where we work where we have digital projector, we have film projector, and we have the Avid. And it kind of is like mission control. So during the shoot, again, it was all shot in LA because of COVID. So great. We could, at the beginning of the shoot or the end of the shoot day, come and gather together and have a drink and just watch the dailies from the day before. Usually, it's a lot of the time, it's before we're getting it digitally. We get the film first because that's just the way that everything gets processed, the scanning. It just, the pipeline is so unique, and we actually get prints first. So that's the first time we're seeing it is on print. We just judge so many things. We can judge the performance is big, and we can look at the lighting and look at the lenses and focus. And Paul's wearing so many hats. He's the writer, and he's the producer and director and a co-cinematographer. So there's a lot in his head. So when he's watching dailies, he's analyzing so many different elements. Especially for comedy, we will have a little group of people, the camera crew and some other key members, and then we can just see how things play, what gets laughs. And I'll take notes, and we've usually figured out a lot of our favorite takes at the end of the little session. And I'll have a big binder at the end where I can use that to help build the movie later. And it's just, honestly, it's the best thing. Just being there in the room, and now that I've been around for so long with him, I can just look at him and see, okay, he's liking this or he's not liking this. It's just that nonverbal communication sometimes, or body language. Or sometimes we can just look at each other and we're like, okay, that's a perfect moment. So it's the best. And then he'll sometimes decide whether he's going to reshoot something. We'll have a discussion of, is this working? Or, you know, I don't like how the camera's moving here. I don't like how the lighting is. So we'll reshoot it. And it's built into the schedule that there's going to be stuff that gets reshot. But I mean, it's great because I know some directors do watch dailies on picks, but I don't think a lot of directors, just because if there's all this stuff that's getting shot or there's multiple cameras, or just there's no way. It's not enough hours in the day to watch the dailies and really know what you got. And so with him, he just makes it a priority to watch dailies. And by the end of the shoot, we know we have the movie.
I think how invaluable it is to be able to watch the dailies with a group, with the director specifically, of course, to be able to, like you said, that nonverbal stuff, a little sigh or impatience or a big smile, whatever it is. But other people, just to hear that is fantastic. I did one movie where every Saturday we prepped select dailies and we watched it as a team. And it was great to be able to sit next to the director and hear that stuff. Because normally, right, we watch the dailies and you're by yourself. You have no other sense of anybody other than you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's great.
When you watch the dailies with this group of people and you're obviously taking notes, probably longhand on a piece of paper, then you have to go back into your NLE and watch the dailies again. How do you combine those two dailies watching processes?
Well, first of all, as we're watching dailies as a group, Paul and I have chosen the takes that we like. So I've usually starred a bunch. So we've at least done some of the work already. As I'm watching the stuff in the Avid, I'll add markers. I'll usually do like a color for myself, which is stuff that I like. And then I'll also do a different color for Paul of things that he has kind of responded to or things that I've written down that we like. And then usually you have your scene bin and there's each take in a row. So our like favorite takes, I'll just move up. The top take, I'll move the most. And if there's like a second or third favorite take, I'll just move it up a little bit. And sometimes I'll put like a star, star, star or best first half or something like that. So for me, I'll always have the notes when I have a scene up that I can look at. But if you just open up your bin, I can see right away, these are my favorite takes. This was our favorite one and this was our second or third favorite one. And just visually, it is so much easier for me to pinpoint. And then I can click on those. And then in the markers, I can see certain moments. But we don't do scripting. We don't do any of that. It's just very...
No script sync.
No. The John Peters section, a few of those scenes, there was a lot of improv. So I did have Jay mark those up with locators just so that we kind of knew when certain lines were. But no, don't use script sync at all. So really, I'll just open up the scene and I'll see my favorite takes, and then I'll do usually the little selects sequence in that bin and pull my favorite things. And then sometimes I'll do a little rough cut of the scene. And so that's how I get to know the footage again. Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that the best take in a specific setup, you're literally lifting it a couple millimeters up in a bin. Of course, for the poor person who's OCD, they're like, no, it has to be a straight line.
Like, I know.
No.
I remember working for editors that were like that. You had to make sure it was exactly right. That just works for me. And it probably will make other people crazy, especially if their monitor's a different size. But even when we do these little music videos, when we're just watching stuff right away, I can just move stuff up. And then I don't forget. If you lose the piece of paper or the notes where it's written on, you can at least go to the bin and just see, oh, okay, well, it's got to be one of these three that we liked.
You're not the first editor that I've talked to that has said that that's what they do. I've talked to several that they say that the best take, they move it up a little bit. It's higher than the other ones.
Exactly.
The other thing that I love, and I would love to hear you talk about, is there's circled takes. So we know on the day of what the director thinks is good, but very often that's the wrong thing. Like if the director sees that later, they're like, oh, that's not the best take. Did that happen? You know, were his onset instincts the same as his instincts during dailies?
It's interesting how he works on set, because he doesn't really say that's my favorite take. Mm. We have a script supervisor that we worked with, Jillian, for a number of movies. She also has this shorthand. She kind of can feel the body language or whether he likes it or not. So, and just the way that the process is, where the performances will change as the scene's getting shot. You can just watch the footage and you can kind of know, okay, he didn't like this lens, so we moved to this other lens. And then we changed the lighting and, oh, okay, Gary started doing this other thing. So then it kind of evolves to these three takes that are good. And then Jillian, she's able to write little notes to me. She's great because she can kind of give me a heads up of what stuff to notate. Of course, sometimes we go to takes from the beginning for whatever reason down the line, but he has a really good instinct about when things are working. And it's not like we'll just watch only the circle takes during dailies. Sometimes we'll watch only like a few setups. You're stuck, again, this like old school thing. You're stuck with the camera rolls, right? Or the lab rolls, I guess they call it. The lab rolls are just how it's built at Photochem. So sometimes you'll have the first few takes of something and then the next roll will have 4, 5, 6 and then takes 1 and 2 of the next setup, because it's all just based on length. So you have to be strategic of which lab rolls you choose to watch during dailies.
Oh, interesting.
I've kind of gotten good at that, because you don't want to be just sitting there sifting through bad takes, because you can't fast forward on film. It just is real time. So you have to figure out, oh, I guess we're going to jump. So jump to the next roll and figure out when that is, so that we get a good sense of the dailies of what we shot, but you're not just sitting there for hours and hours. But also, Paul's not shooting multiple cameras. I mean, we rarely shoot multiple cameras. It's usually a single camera, and we're moving around, and that's just his process.
I wanted to play a scene for you which has a beautiful, really sweet music. This is the first walk home as the two of them are walking home, and just the score is almost like Renaissance. It's like a harpsichord. I just love it. I want to play this for you.
If I asked for your phone number, would you give it to me?
Why should I give you my phone number?
So I can call you?
I don't know, Gary.
Why not?
How are you gonna remember it?
It's only 7 numbers.
Seven, five, eight, four, six, eight, six.
756-4686?
Where are you going wrong?
758-4686.
All right, Don Rickles. Don't call me all the time, okay? We're not boyfriend and girlfriend. Remember that.
Yeah, that was always meant to be a oner. Oftentimes, we won't even do coverage on certain scenes because Paul's like, this is going to be a oner. And this is what it is. So that section, and then the section at the end when they're running towards each other, that is Johnny's score. Those are the only times in the movie where we use score. All the other times are needle drops. And so that was by design. We did have a temp piece that was in that also had a harp sound like that. And so...
Oh, yeah. It's a harp, not a harpsichord.
We used that for a while. And then ultimately, we just sent the cut to Johnny and he wrote something and then decided to kind of use that theme at the beginning and the end. We decided, obviously, to just build the music for that final sequence. Otherwise, it would just been too thin.
Totally get it. There's a scene where he gets arrested. Do you remember what the music choice is for that arrest scene?
Are you talking about the whole Teenage Fair sequence?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's Blue Sands. So that is a Chico Hamilton quintet. That is just a piece that we licensed. So we use it throughout the entire sequence. It starts at the beginning when he's walking in and edited it to kind of hit certain dramatic notes. And then it slowly eases away when he's just sitting there alone in the police station being like, how did I get into this mess?
I mean, that was a great, impactful scene. It shows that she cares about him. There's great character building in that. Are there things that you use as gold standards for whether a scene stays or goes that you would suggest to Paul? I actually heard you talk to Matt Fury about the scene where he says he's going to marry Alana. I met the girl that I'm going to marry.
Oh, right, with the brother.
Short little scene.
Yeah.
Right? And it does give you that sense that he's not after just sex. He really loves her. And so it's an important scene, but I think you mentioned at some point you cut it out and put it back in, or at least considered cutting it out.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of factors. There's, as I touched on in that, the plot is not really that important to the movie. It really is about this evolving relationship between these two characters and the back and forth. So you always want to serve that purpose is to the relationship between these two characters. But then also just the way the movie's structured in these sort of episodes, you had to make sure that they're all, I don't want to say equal, but that there's not certain sections that are outweighing others, because then it's going to start dragging. So it's a balance of just what feels right, because that scene between him and his brother, it adds something to Gary, especially at the beginning of the movie. You are setting up the two of them. It's so important to set up who they are as people, and you want to root for them. You want to root for Gary. So it adds a humanity. It adds something nice. So it's just a balance of all those things. And this movie is just so unique because you can't really put a label on it, because it is coming of age story and sort of a romance and kind of a meandering slice of life kind of thing. It's sort of adventure movie. It's a very unique piece.
Yeah, I love it. The interesting thing to me is if you ever did cut it out, you wouldn't necessarily notice that it doesn't work to have it gone just by playing the two scenes that butt up now because you cut that out. You would only feel it later in the movie that was missing, right?
Right, totally.
Yeah, you need to be watching the whole to go, oh, now the ending doesn't feel right, or now this moment feels a little creepy instead of sentimental.
Yeah, or think about the prank call scene when he's sitting there with his brother and then goes off to call Alana. If we had not really set up the brother at all, that would have been kind of jarring. I don't know. It adds like a fun element, knowing that the kid from 20 minutes earlier or 10 minutes earlier, whatever it is, that's his whole life is him and his brother. And now there's this new element, Alana. And so now it's like kind of a triangle between the three of them. You're right. It is a domino effect.
Yeah. There's a scene in their first date, which of course is not a date for Alana, where they go to the Tale of the Cock and they're sitting in the bar. And it might be long enough ago that you can't remember, but I think that's held on her for the entire conversation in the bar without cutting a second.
Yep.
It's a oneer.
Yep, it's a oneer. Yep.
But he is doing most of the talking. So talk to me about the purpose of that. I'm assuming you had coverage.
Yeah, we did. I don't know. Sometimes you just get these magical takes, and her reactions throughout the movie, they're just so good. That's one of the reasons why we stayed with her at the beginning of the movie, too, is just her reactions when she first meets Gary are just priceless. And it tells you so much about who she is. We just found we had this take. That might have been a scene that we actually reshot, because I think we shot that one way. And then Paul had the idea. I think he knew potentially we might stay in as a oneer, but we did do coverage. But that was an example of a scene that did get reshot. And once it got reshot, kind of worked out these kinks so that we could keep it as a oneer.
Love
if
it.
That makes sense. And the breathing and all that stuff. Sometimes the timing works out perfect. And just staying on the shot the whole time, you just feel there's just something so authentic to it. You don't feel manipulated.
True. And later on, right after that oneer, is a scene with them at dinner. And I don't know if you've ever heard this term called dragnetting. It's a pejorative term, and you did not do it, but it's basically when you're always on the person who's speaking. And what I loved about this scene, and I want to play it for you so you can talk about it a little bit, is that it just felt right the exact moment you were always on the person that you were on instead of the person who was talking. So I want to play that scene for you real quickly and then have you just talk us through this. So we start out with him asking her, what are your plans?
What are your plans?
I don't know.
What's your future look like?
I don't know.
How do you like working at Tiny Toes?
I hate working at Tiny Toes.
You should start your own business.
What business should I be in?
I don't know. What do you like?
I don't know.
You're an actress. You should be an actress.
So how'd you become such a hotshot actor?
I'm a showman. It's my calling. I don't know how to do anything else. It's what I'm meant to do. I mean, ever since I was a kid, I've been a song and dance
man. Come on. Ever since you were a kid, song and dance man. Where are your parents?
My mom works for me.
Oh, of course she does.
Yes, she does, in my public relations company.
In your public relations company? Because you have that.
Yes.
And you're an actor.
Yes.
And you're a secret agent, too.
Well, no, I'm not a secret agent. That's funny.
Yeah, so these takes of Gary at the beginning, this was an amazing take that we found where, I don't know, just his expressions were so perfect and kind of innocent.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he's like a showman. He's a child actor. He's trying to impress her, but there's kind of an innocence to it. And I don't know, we just love this take. Some of his expressions when he's like putting his hands out. What do they call that? Jazz hands?
Jazz hands.
He's just always performing. He's always performing, yeah. Right? And so, but he's also contained too. He's trying to contain himself, but he's still performing. So it was a great thing to find this dynamic between his side and that performance and then her just being so dismissive. Not so dismissive. That's maybe the wrong word because she is amused by it. Obviously, she's kind of enjoying the attention. That's the reason why she's here in the first place. It was just finding these great takes between the two of them.
Do you have a discussion with Paul or do you just intuit on your own? What is the purpose of the scene? And so that guides you. Like if the purpose of the scene is she can't believe she's there despite herself and he can't believe his good fortune that he convinced this girl to go, then that tells you where to be or no?
Not really. It's funny. This is the scene that we did a screen test on. So
really?
When we were first doing screen tests between the two of them, it was this scene. So they kind of knew this scene really well, and we had already cut the scene using the old footage. So that was an interesting evolution because the script did change a little bit, but the style was always the same. He's this showman, and she's not taunting him, but responding sarcastically, getting more information, sometimes a little impressed, but it's all with this veil of sarcasm until the end, until that moment when he says, I'm never going to forget you. And that catches her off guard. So that's sort of the arc of the scene. And Paul's style has always been to not make things too cutty. So the challenge is always trying to figure out the right moments to cut. You want to keep the best performances, but he's fine sometimes just staying on a character and hearing the other character over the shoulder and just watching the character on screen. It's may not be the absolute perfect timing, but he's okay with that.
There's actually a section of this scene that I kind of feel like that's like that when it's over her shoulder. But if you cut to her for that, then it becomes too cutty. Is that it?
Yes, exactly. And you can see that showman thing that he's doing in that moment, even when she's starting to talk. Plus, he kind of does this licking of his lips.
Yeah.
Which we use throughout the movie. He does that a bunch. Whenever we saw that, we would sometimes try to keep that in because it just adds a innocence. So it's something a teenager would do. It's not so polished.
It's not so polished. I love it. So instead of cutting it out because you think, oh, I don't want to see him lick his lips, you think that adds to his character and tells us something about him.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that Paul would sometimes say to me, there would be a sequence that I'd show him, and sometimes he'd say, you know, it's too perfect. Make it less perfect. And I think in movies nowadays, we're so used to everything being cut so tightly, perfect, just the rhythm of scenes just being so perfect. And I've really taken that to heart, because you then take the sequence and you just make something that's a little off, half second off, or again, just staying on a shot. And maybe there is a little bit more of a gap than there should be, but it just feels more natural, feels more human. And it adds something, even with some of these musical sequences that we do, which are calculated for certain moments to happen on certain beats of the song. Sometimes that too will decide, just let's make it a little off and it'll still work. So that's like a little lesson that I've learned from him.
I think I've mentioned this before, but there's this Japanese term called wabi-sabi, which is the beauty of something that's imperfect.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. And also with things like camera bumps and little camera movements, if something's egregious, of course, we'll fix it, but he likes having that little just human touch to it. In fact, sometimes things that we stabilize, again, not that much, maybe I think there's like three shots that we stabilized or two shots that we stabilized in this movie. I pulled back. I was like, it's too much. We need to see a little bit more of a human touch to it because it was too perfect.
Mm. Before the tail of cock scene, he walks to his house with the lunchbox. And what's the value of that? You know, I know it's a pejorative term, shoe leather. What's the value sometimes of showing going from one place to another or spending a moment just walking someplace?
That scene is also kind of setting up the neighborhood, and that we're in the valley, we're in the suburbs, just your cookie cutter streets. And you can tell from this little sequence that this is their routine, right? I'm sure he goes and he picks his brother up and they go to some restaurant, wherever it is, because his mom's working, and they'll go eat and then he'll take him home and then they'll watch the Dodger game. So it's kind of setting up their routine.
Also, that scene, I believe there's a pre-lap of the audio into the living room. Can you talk about the value of a pre-lap and what it gives you?
It's just a great way to kind of link two things together. And the audience now, we're so used to film language and stuff. So when we hear pre-laps like that, you instantly realize, okay, we're going to be moving forward in time. So it's kind of like a way to time jump, essentially. And not always, but usually that's the way that editors do that. The Dodger game, that was something we had to put in. There's all these little details throughout, all these little radio things, songs, things in the background, things on the TV. We try to pepper those in as much as possible just to add to the authenticity of the time period, because it's such a nostalgic movie, not only recreating this time and the place of San Fernando Valley, but just being a kid during that time. This movie couldn't happen nowadays with cell phones and text messages. Can you imagine? Or the prank call scene? People would know exactly who's calling. Where are you? Texting someone, where are you? Instead of running around trying to find them. Yeah. So you're capturing this time period that is, you're never going to get back. You're never going to have that anymore.
Yeah, I just saw a tweet from somebody who said, I just found out today that there was a phone number you could call and it would tell you what time it was. And that started this whole thing about, oh, did you know that you could press a series of buttons and call back the person who just called you, which is what she does, right? She must have pressed, I remember what it was, star 86 or something that would call.
Maybe,
call
or I mean, they probably knew each other's numbers. So
yeah,
who knows?
You'd have to ask Paul whether he thinks that she just pressed a call back who just called me. I don't know.
I mean, I don't think star 86 was around back then. So I think she maybe sensed like, oh, it's not Lance on the phone, so it must be Gary.
Exactly. There's a great cut that I love. Again, it's film language. It's film grammar, I think, in a way, where it's the smash cut that happens after the mom says, oh, you know, you're not going to be able to go to New York because you don't have a chaperone. Boom. He's on an airplane, right? Was there anything between that, or was that scripted to be where she says that we cut to the airplane, basically?
And that was scripted like that.
Yeah, love it.
And then we always were going to use the song in that moment. That really launches the whole story. The first reel is just kind of setting up the two of them and their dynamics. That's actually the beginning of reel two. That launches us really into their adventure. Once they're on the plane, and then we're going. And then we're kind of going fast, scene to scene to scene to scene, and we just keep moving and moving and moving. So
yeah, I love that cut. One of the things that I had a question about was there's a scene with a black woman in the waterbed scene when he first gets to see what a waterbed is. Those shots of her are really close. Talk to me about the choice of that big close-up of her, what it got you, why you or Paul felt Like, that's what we want to do, is be big close.
I mean, I think it was just a decision that was made on set. There's a kind of a motif throughout the movie of close-ups. I mean, we'd use it a lot. We didn't have choices. I mean, I think Paul knew at that moment. He kind of gets entranced by her and lured in to the business. So I think that was it. It was just getting this connection between her, Brenda is her name, between Brenda and Gary. And the camera tracks alongside her as she's looking at him in close-up. That was a directorial choice.
Yeah. You don't realize it when he first sees the waterbed, but then, of course, that becomes a huge part of the movie. And so having a close-up, that tells you the importance of something, I think. So I want to talk about intercutting. There's a sequence with Alana running at night, trying to find Gary, and flashbacks to other scenes of her running. Can you talk about trying to tweak those moments where you're like, when exactly do we cut to those flashbacks, and when do we cut back to live action?
Right. In our initial cut, that was not in there. Mm. It was just running back and forth. And then we had this idea, what if we did cut back to some previous moments in the movie as sort of an intercut? So I just kind of went through. I wanted to make sure we did one where she was running to him after the teenage fair.
Mm-hmm.
So that's her side that we choose. And then his side is when he's running to...
She's fallen off the back of the motorcycle.
Yeah, she's fallen off the back of the motorcycle. Exactly. Those are the two moments that we use in the flashbacks. But it was also sound, too. I mean, so once we got that in and we're like, okay, this actually heightens the emotion. I started taking sound from different scenes and peppering those in earlier as well. So when we first start cutting back and forth between Gary and Alana during that final running sequence, you're hearing kids from the teenage fair, and you're hearing radio from another portion of the movie. And then we were hearing the motorcycle. And it was a combination of using film flashing back, but also sounds.
Mm. I did not realize that.
How we built that.
I love it. I'm sure I was aware of it maybe psychologically, but I didn't.
Yeah, well, hopefully that's it. Yeah, hopefully you're just kind of hearing a little bit of this radio stuff and remembering, oh, it's just taking you back to earlier parts of the movie.
Something else I wanted to ask about is a muse, or sometimes a director will say, hey, let's watch this movie together. And I saw that Paul thought that Fast Times at Ridgemont High and American Graffiti were major influences. Is that something he asked you to watch or no?
Well, American Graffiti, we watched. We had a print of it and we watched it. It was so ingrained. We were talking about it all the time. I mean, even the titles at the beginning, that green font that we used throughout, that is inspired by the first title in American Graffiti, Lucasfilm font. So that was our little throwback to that. And even the cherry bomb at the beginning of the movie, too, is a throwback to the cherry bomb in American Graffiti. There's just so many elements of that movie. Again, it's not like we're trying to copy that movie, and it's not really the same kind of movie, but it's
right.
Just the essence of it is like Paul's version of American Graffiti in a way.
It's more as if American Graffiti was George Lucas's life that he turned into a movie, and Licorice Pizza is Paul Thomas Anderson's version of his childhood or growing up. Coming of
exactly.
Age.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I love that. I don't know if you want to talk any more about the music drops. I'm assuming some of them were in the script. And then talk to me about you building a playlist probably from Paul, correct?
Yeah, he's so in tune with music. He always has been. And so he was choosing songs as he was writing the script. And there were a lot of things in the scripts notating certain kind of songs. The process is he plays a lot of music during dailies. So that's it's kind of a way in which we can whittle down a playlist or some songs that are going to potentially be in a sequence. He can whittle down to, okay, these are maybe the favorites. And then I don't show him a big assembly of the movie. That's not how we work. We do the dailies and I take the notes. And I have my own process of going through the digital dailies again and making selects. And sometimes they'll do a little rough cut, but he doesn't want to just watch a 4-hour version of the movie where I've just put all these songs in. It's just not his process. I can have it on the side, but he doesn't want to see that. He wants to build it with me. And so that's how we do it. Sometimes we're just roughing in shots and then I'll go back and do coverage, but just building sort of the roadmap of the movie I do with him. And a lot of the times that also includes putting songs in. And of course, we'll change stuff up depending, but that's kind of how we do it.
I love it because there's the idea that a specific song is in there in the script, for example. Oh, I think this would be a good choice for this moment. But then there's also, here's just a big playlist that you can then dive into, I'm assuming.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we just try stuff. I mean, that's what's so great. You can just have different tracks. And in fact, the stumbling in track, the moment you're talking about for the plane, I think I talked in that other interview about how that wasn't actually period accurate. So we tried a bunch of things and we were trying all these songs, and it just sometimes the song just feels right. It's just the perfect thing. And so you have to use it. But other spots, like the Life on Mars, that was in there from the beginning and we never changed that. And Let Me Roll It too. Because that kind of was the way that Paul did the choreography with them laying on the bed and looking over and their pinkies touching, all that stuff. I mean, it was, it's not like we made it like a music video, but there were certain moments of the song that we wanted to heighten with these images. So it just worked so well with that song. And he had that song in mind.
Did you also go through on your own and go, okay, 1973 and maybe back to whenever, late 60s, I'm going to go find my own tracks and add them in? Or did you just figure that Paul's were perfect and you're going to go with that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that would be a smart idea. Just like, by the way, I just changed all the music cues. I don't know about that.
Yeah, totally get it.
But you talk to him. You're like, you know, I don't know if this is working. What else could we find? Just a dialogue.
And did you know specifically, you said that the two places where there's score, were there other places where you felt there should be score and you did temp score or no? Nothing.
Never. No, never. It was always the idea to do just score there. You could say, oh, well, why didn't you do score during the truck sequence? You know, and maybe other directors would have done that, but we thought it worked so well not having music there. It's kind of wall-to-wall music. And then once you hit that John Peters section, it's dry for like 15 minutes. It's only the truck sounds you're hearing. You're hearing some distant songs playing at the gas station or whatever, but that's it. So I don't know. It's a good contrast.
Yeah. Sometimes you just have to open it up to that, right? It makes it stand out because there's no music when there's so much music in the rest of the movie.
Yeah. I think it almost is more tense. I think it plays better by just hearing the neighborhood sounds and the truck sounds.
Yeah.
I think that, especially when it's going backwards, you're more in it.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a 1970s sound and truck. The sounds are interesting by themselves and you don't want to clash or have them be overrun by music.
Absolutely. And the sound guys were great. We had a lot of good stuff that they recorded on set, but especially when it's going backwards, they put this extra sound of a roller coaster, like an old roller coaster sound when it goes backwards and then it stops. And then you see that profile shot of Alana and Gary and the truck starts moving forward. If you listen to that, it's like a roller coaster starting to go up.
That's fantastic.
The track, it just adds such a cool little element. And especially then at the very end too, it just extra rattling makes that a very dynamic moment.
I love it. To wrap things up, since we're on sound, I have often had to fight with directors to get me into the sound mix. Talk to me about the importance of you being there to say, oh my gosh, that's a great idea. Or no, the sound that I put in has a certain character and we need that. Or I'm missing a sound that you took out. Talk to me about being in the sound mix and why an editor should be in a sound mix.
I think most editors would say, especially sound in the Avatrax, you sometimes really have to do a lot of work to make things work, whether you're pulling sounds from other takes or different dialogue and you really know where the bodies are buried, so to speak. And things just sometimes get lost, or sometimes people are like, oh, that didn't matter, when it really does matter. Even the first date scene, you can hear all this clanging of silverware and stuff. Some of that was in the tracks, but we don't want to clean all that stuff up. Mm-hmm. Paul likes to keep that natural sound, because if it's too clean, again, it just doesn't feel authentic. That's usually what we're doing. The sound guys that we work with are great, and they now kind of know Paul's sensibility, and it's always like, okay, it's too clean. Put back some of that stuff. Put back some of that air. So we're usually like dirtying it up more. We barely do ADR either. I mean, I think there's a one ADR line in this movie because he just doesn't like how it sounds and we just try to make it work. And in Phantom Thread, there's zero.
Wow.
So we get really good sound recordists, but we really try to keep the authenticity, even if it's just not the most perfect sound.
That's interesting. I can also think that for you to know that kind of a thing about your director would also help you choose even which microphone to choose in a production track. Sometimes I try to avoid the lavs, even though sometimes they're cleaner because the boom just sounds more real, or there's more, like you said, there's more air to it. There's more life to that boom. Do you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the lav usually kind of has that muffled sound. Obviously, the sound team can make lav sound good when they're doing the mix, but personally, I agree. I think that the boom sounds better. But because everyone knows that Paul wants to try to be authentic as possible, so that means barely doing visual effects, right? Not doing ADR, not doing a lot of windows, because we are cutting negative. So that means you're using the image. You can't do windows when you're doing a photochemical finish.
Meaning not doing windows means resolve power windows in color correction, that you're not
exactly
making one part of the scene look darker or brighter than another part.
Exactly. You can't do that when you're doing photochemical. Everything is the old way of doing it. So everyone's aware of that. And the camera operator and focus puller, everyone's got to be on it. So as far as sound goes, they'll put little mics in plants or different places around the set to try to capture it, because everyone knows we don't want to do ADR later. And all the running, I mean, Lisa Panera, who was the sound mixer, I mean, we were doing camera tests early on, but we had to make sure that we could capture the sound with all the running and not get it, the scuffs that you would get.
Mm-hmm. So they invited a bicycle with a big boom on it.
We actually did at one point, for one of our tests, the camera was on like a souped up golf cart kind of thing following along with them. And then there was a boom at one point. I don't think that really worked that well, but they figured it out.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining me. This was a really, really interesting conversation, and I really appreciate you chatting with us about this.
Thanks, Steve.
That's it for Art of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to my guest, Andy Jurgensen. Also, thanks to Jake Gum for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hullfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.